Welcome, and aren't you glad you're in here where there's no test being taken? Because I could just see all those people in the hallway who were studying for tests, and it made me nervous just walking by them. So as I think I told you on Monday, today we're starting what I call the Empire Strikes Back. Sorry, that was the only Star Wars slide you're getting. Although maybe we'll see if I can't find another one for Monday. And what I mean by that is we are looking at mid-century evaluations of colonialism. So these are coming later than Conrad's. And along with empire and colonialism, we're going to talk about other values that are revisited. And there's also a new question that's raised in these texts, which is what's the toll that empire and colonialism has on the people who are dominated, but also on the people who are doing the dominating? What does dominating do to a person who exercises power? So today I'll start by talking about some of the hierarchies that get challenged in the reading for this week and next. As usual, I'll give you a brief bio of Forrester. We'll talk about the life to come, and then we'll also end. I'll give you some reading questions. And I want to just remind you what's happening in class on Friday, because again, this week's a little different than what we've done before. Just as a reminder, if you are going to revise that first paper, it is due on Monday at the beginning of class. I didn't put this on the assignment, but all you need to hand in is a hard copy with your draft attached. You do not need to upload the revision in Blackboard, okay? So, let's get started. So, we might think of British culture as relying on a lot of hierarchies, a number of hierarchies. And when I say this, I don't mean that anybody would explicitly say this in the period, but that if you had asked them a question, well, who do you assume should govern? Who do you assume should have power in this culture? And if you could get people to articulate their assumptions, this is what it would look like, okay? And they're sort of, in some ways, quite clear binaries. So whereas we would see on the side of privileged and governed, the British and their European allies would see themselves as, of course, they should be the ones in that position. And of course, colonial subjects should be the suppressed. They should be the ones that are governed, okay? Now, by the way, some of these first ones will sound quite familiar to you from Heart of Darkness, so this is should sound familiar. Second, of course, is white. Actually, I should have put Caucasian, which is the correct racial term. And almost any other race you can think of, they would have assumed would be in the position of being governed. In this early period, no one would ever dream that that relationship could ever be reversed. Privileged and governed would be, of course, Christian, they would have assumed. And almost any other religion would have been thought of as pagan. And, you know, it's funny because the British in particular in the 19th century and earlier always thought that what you were doing in a colonial relationship was bringing the benefits of Christianity to the unenlightened. They would never have thought that, you know, other religions would have something to teach them. Men and women. This is a bit more obvious. We certainly saw that a bit play out in Pygmalion. But just as a reminder, historically, women weren't able to own property until quite close to the 20th century. They couldn't vote until into the 20th century. They couldn't have professions until into the 20th century. Heterosexuality and homosexuality, which comes up in our reading for today. We'll be talking about this. To the extent that anybody would have talked about homosexuality in the early 20th century, you know, there would be this assumption that that was a deviant behavior. That's the word choice they would have used. Now, that's not to say that there aren't communities of, you know, homosexual men and women who felt quite different about their sexuality, but you certainly don't have a gay rights movement as we do in contemporary times. And then finally, upper class and lower class, right? And even, you know, you could put the middle class somewhere in the middle because they're always trying to sort of get themselves on the governing side of things but are often looked down upon. So again, think of these as unarticulated, not spoken assumptions, but they are assumptions upon which the culture rests. And so let me just tell you a little bit about E.M. Forster, and then we're going to come back to these and think about how he's using them, okay? But I also want you to have these in your mind when you're doing your reading for Friday and for Monday, because all of the reading that we're doing this week, what happens when the Empire Strikes Back is that people on the right side of this are no longer taking their position as governed for granted. You see them acting up, acting against, striking out at a hierarchy that had been firmly in place for, you know, most of history at that point. Okay, E.M. Forster, looking pensive up there, looking thoughtful, was born in 1879, died in 1970, so he's an interesting figure in that he lives quite a ways into the 20th century. He's one of these people who lives to see many of those cultural hierarchies challenged. He had a privileged upbringing. He was educated at Cambridge. He traveled quite widely afterwards. He went to Greece, Italy, and Egypt, which is interesting, I think. And we can think of, you know, that travel, that education, as pretty typical of the writers that I talked about earlier in the week as canonical, right? These are the writers that we end up reading, because if you live a life of privilege, it's obviously easier to write great literature. Now, just as a reminder, D.H. Lawrence is one figure who would challenge that. Virginia Woolf is a writer who actually talks about it explicitly. Coming back to Forster, he worked in Alexandria, Egypt for a number of years, and specifically for the Red Cross during World War I. And he also made several trips to India and worked as a private secretary to a Maharaja, an Indian man, in 1921. And what that means is Forster, perhaps better than almost anybody else that we'll read, had a real understanding of what it was like for the people who were governed, right? He knew people who were in that position quite intimately. Now, Forster wrote several acclaimed novels. If you've ever heard of A Passage to India, that's probably his best-known novel. Some of his novels have been turned into films, so he's somebody you can run into pretty easily. And he also was close friends with Virginia Woolf. So if you saw any similarity between the way he writes and the way Woolf writes, they knew each other quite well and shared their work. One of the things that's so interesting about Forster is that he lived his life as a closeted gay man. He had a long-term partner who was actually a policeman, which I find so interesting because male homosexuality was illegal. You could be arrested and imprisoned for being a male homosexual, which is why he was closeted, and yet, you know, it's just interesting to me that it's a policeman that he spends his life with. His aesthetic philosophy was only connect. And I think that's a nice phrase because what he's encouraging people to think about is, what are the connections between people in a culture? What are the connections between people in different cultures? What are the things that keep us from connecting, from understanding one another? Those are the kinds of issues that his fiction really revolves around. So the life to come is actually a good representative of the kind of work Forster wanted to do and what he could do. So when I have up there, he worked on it starting in 1922, and he continued to revise it all the way through the 1960s. But it was not published until 1972, which is 2 years after his death. He also had a novel called Morris that was like this. And the reason was that he felt it was not safe for him, his literary reputation, to admit that he was interested in thinking about homosexuality in literary works. And, you know, certainly he didn't want it let out that he was gay. So, you know, it's an interesting story because it responds to a particular historical moment, but it's not published in that historical moment because of the limitations that he suffered under. And we're going to start by thinking about a similarity to Conrad with The Life to Come. And that is that this story helps us think about an idea, right, that's at the back of a colonial relationship. And here, in this case, it's the thin end of a wedge, we might think. So the idea is the thin end of the wedge that gets into a foreign culture and that leads to a colonial takeover. And I'm just going to show you where you see this in the story. We'll start with the section night. The story is helpfully entirely organized around time markers, right? And if you start with the section night, you'll see that it starts with what seems to be a genuine interest in religious practice. Paul Pinmay, our protagonist, seems really earnestly concerned with converting the natives to Christianity, right? That is why he comes to this particular country. By the way, let me just step back for a minute and say one thing that's so interesting about Forrester's story is he doesn't tell us where this is, right? I mean, in Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, we know specifically what part of Africa is being described because of the way he talks about the maps. But here, we don't know. It could be somewhere in Africa. It could be someplace in India or, you know, the East. It could even really be someplace in South America. He leaves it quite wide open. Let's just stop there for a second. This is what happens when you get interested in something you hadn't planned on, but I think it's important. Why do you think he does that? Why do you think he doesn't identify where Vithibai is, where Paul Pinmay goes to? Why do you think we don't have it narrowed down as we do in Conrad? Yeah. Okay, good. I think that's a really good point. If there isn't a specific place, more people can identify with the story, right? Any other ideas? Yeah. Okay. He said that if you don't have a specific place, you think about all the places the British had influence in and all the places they were governing. I think those are both really good points. That, you know, it helps us think about this story and the implications of it, right, in bigger terms. This is not just a story about what happened to some small community in a specific place. This is a story that could be anywhere, that could be everywhere under the British Empire. And I know it's hard to remember back, but if you think of that map I showed you on the first day of class that showed how far the British Empire extended, that really opens the range, right? I mean, you know, again, the sun never sets on the British Empire. Well, it perhaps never sets on these kinds of situations. Okay, back to Paul Pinmay, back to religion. Now, as I said, as the story starts, he seems genuinely interested in converting people to Christianity. He's a young, enthusiastic missionary. He's there because he feels he might succeed where other people have failed. But that ends pretty quickly, right? His enthusiasm, his general religious fervor to you know, reach people fades pretty quickly. Anybody have a suggestion of where you see that happen in the story? Where you see, he starts by emphasizing love, but love goes out the window within the first couple pages. Anybody have a guess of where, or, you know, a memory of where you see that? Where you see that love is gone. The ideal is gone. The Christian religion is fading. Okay, okay. As soon as he reacts, I think you're right, to what has happened in the hut, and just as a reminder, the story starts after the event has happened, but through memories, we're told that he came to this village to try to convert the natives. In public, the prince Vithibai rejected him, right? But in private, Vithibai comes to him at night. They have a sexual encounter, which we'll talk about a little later. And immediately, as he just said, Paul is upset. He throws the Bible in the river. He leaves the hut. And he tries to run away. Look on 2305. This is where you get the description of him leaving. Yes, thank you. 2205. Sorry, I gave you the wrong page number. This is the end of that paragraph that's continuing at the top. Looking back at the huge and enigmatic masses of the trees, he prayed to them to keep his unspeakable secret, to conceal it even from God. And he felt in his unshinned state that they had the power to do this and that they were not ordinary trees. So when he's by himself, he's mostly concerned that nobody find out about his secret, right? By the way, there's something really interesting about that line I just read. When he describes the trees as huge and enigmatic, Who does that remind you of? Looking at nature, it's enigmatic, can't quite read it, can't tell what it means. I heard it. Thank you, Conrad, okay? So here we have a similar treatment of nature that we had to Conrad, and Paul is only concerned about keeping his secret. And if you look to the bottom of the next paragraph, when he gets back and talks to his fellow missionaries, he tells them he's failed. And the narrator tells us he had judged it fitter to come away at sunrise. Such was his story, told in a mixture of missionary jargon and of slang. And toward the close, he was looking at his colleagues through his long eyelashes to see whether they suspected anything. So he starts with real religious fervor. He starts with an ideal, but very quickly he's just concerned with keeping his secret, right, which he sees as shameful. And as the story continues in each of the next sections, you see that he goes from love to feeling shame to just wanting to take over. In evening, when Paul is talking to this man whose name is now Barnabas, Barnabas tells him, you know, I'll give you anything. You can have anything in my kingdom. You can have my kingdom if you will only come back to me. And this is toward the bottom of 2208. Paul tells him, arise, Barnabas. We do not want your kingdom. We have only come to teach you to rule it rightly. And he also tells him, don't speak of what's happened in the hut. So when Barnabas first offers his kingdom, Paul says, we have only come to teach you to rule it rightly. What happens to that? Is he in fact only concerned with teaching him to rule it rightly? Okay, head shakes. No. No, of course he's not. This sounds awfully nice, right? We are here to teach you to govern better. Who wouldn't have loved the British, right? The whole world would still be under British, you know, influence, if not governance. But instead, that is not what in fact happens. And as the story goes on, you see all the ways in which this little, again, thin ideal, Christianity, love, becomes a way to take over. In day, you get descriptions of Barnabas as having lost his wealth and his kingdom. Toward the bottom of 2209, Bithybi gives Paul a horse and cart for his wedding, and Paul thinks he shouldn't have done it. For the chief was no longer wealthy. In the sudden advent of civilization, he had chanced to lose much of his land. Now think about how funny it is that the narrator puts it that way. In the sudden advent of civilization, he had chanced to lose much of his land. Chanced, right? Here you've got the narrator deliberately using word choice to draw our attention to what's in fact happening. So what's funny about that word chanced? He had chanced to lose much of his land. By luck, by fate. Why use that word? What does it draw our attention to? He had chanced to lose much of his land. Here again, we're just practicing some close reading skills. You need these in your papers. You need them in your revision. Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah, it's irony, right? It's not chance. You know, this is what the whole plan was all along. The British came in. They've got superior technology. They've got, you know, all kinds of techniques they can use. And it's not chance. And so we might say here, it almost sounds like the narrator is telling the story in a way Paul might tell it to himself, right? The narrator is using a kind of word choice here that reflects how the British are thinking about it. Oh, this just chanced to happen. It's a way they kind of disguise from even themselves what's happening. So notice that irony. This narrator has a lot of irony in the way he describes things. And if you just actually flip the page, you see, so 22:10, we get more details about how specifically Bithybi slash Barnabas, remember Barnabas is just the name he uses when he's converted, how he lost it. In the middle of the page, Paul says to Bithybi that he assumes Bithybi is talking about the mining concession. Exactly. I never thought you were treated fairly there. I will certainly approach my future brother-in-law to get you some compensation. But you ought to have been more careful at the time. You signed your rights away without consulting me. I am always willing to be consulted. So there we see one of the ways in which he, quote unquote, chanced, against, hear that irony, to lose his power, his rights. And that is the law, right? He was given a contract. Maybe he didn't understand it. He signed it. And he loses much of his rights, much of the money he could have made by signing his land over. And it seems significant that Forster has it be Paul Pinmay's future brother-in-law, right? So this isn't somebody very different from Paul. This is someone who's quite associated with him. Finally, in mourning, we see the last section. We get a final picture of what has happened to this kingdom. Again, a process that started by an ideal that's quickly lost. The kingdom is utterly despoiled. I hope you noticed that when you read it. By the time you get to the last section and you're looking at the land, you have environmental degradation, you have degradation of the natives. You've got a really, really unfortunate, nasty setting. So we're told that, now Barnabas lives in a small modern house. This is on the top of 2212. That is suitable to his straitened circumstances. And we know that Barnabas is dying from consumption. That's tuberculosis, which came with the Europeans. And throughout this section, Barnabas looks out and he sees a river that's polluted. He sees huge graveyards. And he sees this mine, right, which has completely destroyed the countryside. So this seems to be, again, something we can think about along with Conrad. I would say that Forster depicts it a bit more clearly, because in Conrad, we only get introduced to Kurtz after he's lost his ideal, right? In The Life to Come, we're introduced to Paul Pinmay when he first has it, and then loses it, and then the story carefully traces, step by step, how it is that the process of colonialism, and maybe to use those earlier terms, it turns into conquest, basically, right? Which is not how Paul would have thought of it, but it's certainly the way the narrator depicts it. Okay, any questions about that process before I move on? Okay. So what we're going to do next is move on to what's, I think, really different about what Forster is doing with colonialism. He is thinking about the relationship between homosexuality as part of the same hatred of otherness that is behind racism and colonialism. Now, here's, obviously what's quite new. He is thinking about how other types of identities, by which I mean a sexual identity, can be mapped onto, can be seen to correspond to other kinds of identities that are also oppressed. And what I'm going to do is just go through again and think about this. But first, before I go a little further on, this story makes it quite clear from the narrator's perspective and from Forrester's perspective that Paul Pinmay wants to keep those hierarchies intact that we started the class with. He really wants to keep them intact. And that the problem is not his homosexual activity, but his fear, his inability to see otherness in himself, okay? He cannot acknowledge what he has done because he is so afraid of not staying in that left side of the column that we started the class with. He is so afraid of not being in that position of power that he can't accept his own desire, and he certainly can't accept the person who brought it out of him. And we see this, and I think this is really important. So go back to the beginning of the story. Very first page, 2204. The story starts very deliberately with, I think a word that is key to the first section. Love had been born somewhere in the forest, of what quality only the future could decide. Trivial or immortal, it had been born to two human bodies as a midnight cry. Impossible to tell whence the cry had come, so dark was the forest, or into what worlds it would echo, so vast was the forest. Love had been born for good or evil, for a long life or a short. Now, just think about that word and the impact of starting with that word. Love, right? Love had been born in the forest, and we get that idea repeated twice. Love had been born. If Forrester had started this story with sex had been born, desire had been born, rude animal passion had been born, it would be a very different story, right? But we're told love had been born. And this seems to be a way of encouraging us to think that this is not some fluke. This is not something that Paul Pinmay didn't really want. This is not something we should be disparaging about, right? And again, it comes back to that word choice. So we start with the idea of love, and when Paul remembers what happened, we get more emphasis on this, that this is not something, you know, that came out of nowhere. If you look just on the next page where Paul remembers what had happened, it's on the bottom of 2205, paragraph at the bottom. He recalled Vithibai, the unapproachable, coming into his hut of the darkness and smiling at him. Oh, how delighted he had been. Oh, how surprised. He had scarcely recognized the sardonic chief in this gracious and bare-limbed boy, whose only ornaments were scarlet flowers. Vithibai had laid all formality aside. I have come secretly, were his first words. I wish to hear more about this God whose name is love. And as it continues, we hear about the conversation they had. Paul Pinmay said, come to Christ. Vithibai says, is that your name? Paul tries to explain to him what he means. Just flip the page. And he had opened the Bible at 1 Corinthians 13. By the way, I'm really surprised that your book doesn't footnote this. 1 Corinthians 13 is in the New Testament, and it's probably a passage that you've heard even if you're not a practicing Christian. It's one of these that's just sort of out there. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love does not find fault. And it goes on defining love in really vivid terms. So this is what Paul turns to. And he had read and expounded the marvelous chapter and spoke of the love of Christ and of our love for each other in Christ, very simply but more eloquently than ever before, while Vithibai had said, this is the first time I have heard such words. I like them. And drew closer, his body aglow and smelling sweetly of flowers. And he, this is Paul, saw how intelligent the boy was and how handsome, and determined to win him there and then, imprinted a kiss on his forehead and drew him to Abraham's bosom. And Vithibai had lain in it gladly, too gladly and too long, and had extinguished the lamp. And God alone saw them after that. Now, I want you just to think about the way this is described. It starts right with a really vivid and sensually appealing description of Vithibai. He smells nice. He's got flowers on him. He is, if you flip back to the previous page, gracious and bare-limbed. If I keep emphasizing these things, I'm going to start playing porn music in the back of my head. You know, it's like boom chicka wah wah, you know? Right? He is hot, and the narrator describes him as hot, and he describes him as gracious and lovely. And this comes back to emphasizing that, you know, Paul Pinmay, this is not something that's forced on him, right? This is something he responds to and he goes with. So we see his desire for this man. And along with it, we see two other important things. I want to just remind you that we see the emphasis on the New Testament. And this is not the time or the place for a long history of the difference between the New and the Old Testament. But you might just remember that the Old Testament is where there's a lot of laws. And it's where it's the story of the creation, the story of Moses. It's also got, you know, many of the laws that we think of being associated with Christianity. The New Testament is more the teachings of Jesus and of his apostles. So it's a different emphasis. It's a different emphasis, and Paul starts with the New Testament. He starts with love. He starts with passion for Vithibai, and he starts with embracing him, which leads to the sexual encounter. Right? When you read that he drew him to Abraham's bosom, that is a way that Paul is religiously thinking about his teachings of the church, but it blends into a sexual embrace, right? So one thing kind of bleeds into the other. I think I'm going to take this off. I keep whacking the microphone with it. Those poor people at home, my vast audiences, are getting muffled recordings. Okay, I hope you notice, though, that even though there's real passion here, there's real sensuality, there's real desire, again, it doesn't last very long. 22:06, immediately afterwards, after that passage we've already talked about where Paul throws the Bible out and starts figuring out how he's going to cover things up, he starts to convince himself that this wasn't him, right? It wasn't his doing. In the paragraph that begins, yes, God saw and God sees, in the middle of it, he thinks, why had he, Vithibai, stolen up from the village if not to tempt? Yes, to tempt, to attack the new religion by corrupting its preacher. Yes, yes, that was it. Right? So he starts to convince himself this was just some plot of Vithibai's. And by the end of that paragraph, he condemned with increasing severity the arts of his seducer. On the last topic, he became truly eloquent. And he always found something more to say, and having begun by recommending the boy to mercy, he ended by asking that he might be damned. Now, this is a psychological process probably all of us recognize. If not this same process, we've all done something we feel ashamed of. And then we've all found really nice ways to convince ourselves, it wasn't me, it was the other guy, right? I was persuaded, I was led astray. I didn't mean to do this, this is not my fault. And here you see Paul going through that process, and far from being loving, being condemning Vithibai here. So he starts with passion, starts disavowing it by saying it was his fault. Right, condemning the other person. And we see, as the story goes on, this leads him to a racism he didn't show at the beginning. Flip to 22:07. I'm just going to read you a few lines in the paragraph that begins, since Mr. Pinmay, and I want you to think about what you notice about his changing thought. Okay? As soon as he was installed, this is after he takes over in the area, he set to work energetically. Indeed, his methods provoked criticism, although they were fully justified by their fruits. He, who had been wont to lay such stress on the gospel teaching, on love, kindness, and personal influence, he who had preached the kingdom of heaven as intimacy and emotion, now reacted with violence and treated the new converts and even Barnabas himself with the gloomy severity of the old law. He who had ignored the subject of native psychology now became an expert therein and often spoke more like a disillusioned official than a missionary. So how does that passage help us understand Paul's change? What words stand out to you about how he's now thinking about religion and what he's doing there in this foreign country? What stands out? Hannah?
The concept is in like loving words and violence, and the New Testament is focusing on the old law, the Old Testament.
Okay, good. So instead of love, we have violence. Instead of the New Testament, we have the old. I hope you notice that Forrester describes it as the old law, right? Which is interesting. Instead of the Old Testament, he says law, which is a way of emphasizing the aspects of the Old Testament that Paul Pinmay employs, right? He insists on the law, the rules And is really laying that down here. What else in this passage is new with Paul's thinking? What words stand out as different? We've gone from new to old. We've gone from love to violence. We've gone from, yeah? Okay, good. Yeah, missionary to disillusioned official, right? Again, a missionary, somebody who wants to spread ideals, to somebody who's just, an official is just interested in governing. So that's a really good point. We also have the word native. He thinks of Barnabas here and of his people as natives, whereas in the first section, he's thinking of them as people, right? Now, just think about that word. If you talk about somebody as a native, it's got a whole host, right, of assumptions with it. It means they're not like you. It means they think differently. It means you don't have to treat them the same way, right? And the fact that he starts thinking of Barnabas and his followers as natives is also a significant change. Okay. The narrator at this point in the story gives us some really nice cues about how we're supposed to feel about this. If you flip to page 2208, this is in the same section. Paragraph that begins about three paragraphs down. The suspense of the last few weeks had quite altered Mr. Pinmay's character. He was no longer an open-hearted Christian knight, but a hypocrite whom a false step would destroy. And, you know, if you had any doubt about how you were supposed to feel about this character, the narrator just lays it down here. He calls him a hypocrite, right? By the way, this is kind of an interesting phrase to keep in mind. We call words like that a tonal cue. A tonal cue from the narrator tells you how you're supposed to respond, what the tone is, what attitude the story is taking toward a character or an event. And this, I almost don't want to call it a tonal cue. It's like a tonal smackdown, you know, like he's a hypocrite. And so the narrator very clearly labels him here. And if we think about why, it's pretty clear. He is more worried about being found out, right? He's more worried about his secrets being discovered than doing what's best for Vithibai or the people he's governing. And finally, let me just give you one other place where we know that this term hypocrite seems to be an apt one at this point in the story. Still, if you're on page 2208, right after we're told he's a hypocrite, this is the first time he sees Vithibai after he's come back, and he says he must strike a second blow. That evening, he went in person to the stockade, taking with him two colleagues who had recently arrived and knew nothing of the language. Why would you take two colleagues who know nothing of the language to talk to Vithibai? They're going to be a lot of help, right? Why are they there? It's not to translate. What are they there for? Yeah?
So nothing else would happen. They would do things if they were witnesses.
Okay. So nothing else would happen. And I think you're right. You know, he's bringing his own witnesses. So he's not going to end up back in bed with Vithibai. Right? And so that's why I think that term hypocrite seems apt, because he doesn't trust himself. He still has these desires. Otherwise, there's no reason to bring two people who don't speak the language to meet with the man at this point. So all the way through this, you see this fear of finding otherness in the self, this fear of repressing what's in him and in others. And you see this, I would say, you know, even more clearly as the story goes on. You know, it's so interesting because Forster could have written this story as though Paul Pinmay really, really didn't want those things to happen. He really, really wasn't seriously desiring men. But if you look at the way his marriage is described, page 2209, top of the page, actually it's right after the section that begins day. We're told that he puts down dancing, he encourages industry, and he was marrying one of the medical missionaries, a lady who shared his ideals. and whose brother had a mining concession above the village. Now, let me just say, I hope all of you never marry somebody just because they share your ideals and their brother has a good job, right? This is the most dispassionate description of a marriage you could possibly have. He doesn't marry for love. He doesn't marry for passion. He doesn't marry because he suddenly likes women. Neither does Vithibai. Further down that same page, we're told Vithibai marries too, and he's marrying a woman that the missionaries chose for him, right? So Paul Pinmay goes on. He lives his life, but we do not see that he ever has the passion and desire that he had at the beginning. And as part of this process, though, he has to continue to tamp down his desires and to tamp down those of Vithibai. If you look on the bottom of that page, here again, he's thinking of Vithibai as a native. As a rule, he did not choose to be seen pleasuring with a native. That's the first line of the bottom page. So you can almost see him mentally thinking, native, 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 right? To try and sort of keep that down. And on the next page, I'm not going to look at it closely, but he calls him an inferior, a spiritual inferior. So you see this process of keeping the hierarchies intact by insisting upon these distinctions, superior, inferior, Western, native. Okay. Finally, in mourning, we see a contrast between real Christian love and what Paul ends up offering, I would say both himself and Barnabas, because he's never able to be honest with himself about what he's doing and why he's doing it as the story goes on. You'll remember in the final section of the story that Paul and his wife get the news that Barnabas is dying, and he's dying of tuberculosis. So he's dying of the disease that's been brought in by the English. And Paul only offers Barnabas self-serving sentiments in this section of the tale. 22:12. We'll start there. On his way to seeing Barnabas, this is the end of the paragraph that begins with consumption. Paul is driving his horse and cart to see Barnabas, and he says, as he drove it briskly up through the village, Mr. Pinmay's heart grew lighter, and he thanked God for permitting Barnabas, since die we must, to pass away at this particular moment. He would not have liked to leave him behind, festering, equivocal, and perhaps acquiring some sinister power. This is such an amazing section, right? Because what's he basically thinking? What's he basically thinking here? He's not thinking, don't die, my friend, right? What is he thinking instead? He's happy he's dying, right? Oh, we all have to die, and boy, isn't it great he's doing it now, because I'm leaving, and I'm not leaving a loose end. So again, we have his hypocrisy showing up there, his happiness that he's dying. And in the conversation that follows, he finally decides to clarify their little misunderstanding, as he thinks of it, right? He finally wants to clarify what happened with him, because he's never explained to Vithibai that when I said come to Christ, I didn't mean that. You know, well, he did mean that, but not in that way, right? He's never explained it. He finally does it when there is no risk to himself. This is on 22:13. Third of the way down, there is only one comforter. He glanced around the roof, then fell upon his knees. He could save a soul without danger to himself at last. Come to Christ, but not in the way you suppose, right? Think about that line. He could save a soul without danger to himself at last. There's not much virtue in saving a soul if you haven't done something great to do it, right? If you're more worried about protecting yourself, that doesn't say much about the virtue of your actions. So he could save a soul without danger to himself at last. And Vithibai totally gets that this is what is happening. Toward the bottom of that page, he finally says, I forgive, I do not forgive. He sort of says it doesn't matter at this point. In the middle of that, I lie here empty, but you fill me up with thoughts and then press me to speak them that you may have words to remember afterwards. He's saying basically, you're just doing this for yourself. You are not doing this for me. You are just self-serving at this point. And notice at the bottom of the page, when they're talking about giving each other a goodbye kiss, Mr. Pirme feared to venture the kiss lest Satan took an advantage, right? So he is still afraid at the end and can't trust himself. That leads us to the final point. The story ends with Vithibhai reasserting his power, right? And he does this by stabbing Paul Pinmay to death right before Vithibhai himself dies. And this shows us, right, that the repression of self and other only leads to suffering and death. And I hope you noticed when you read the story that this final action is a blending of both Christian and Vithibhai's native religion. He kills Paul Pinmay because in his native beliefs, if you killed somebody, when you die, they go ahead as a servant. And when Paul says to him, you know, wait for me in the life to come, Vithibhai basically says, life, eternal life, wait for me in it, and he stabs Paul. So he's not going to wait for Paul to come. He's going to send Paul ahead into eternal life. Because Vithibhai thinks he'll serve him there. Okay, so we see what keeping those hierarchies intact, which is what Paul Pinmay has tried to do all the way through, this is what it creates. It creates hatred for others, but the new thing I really want you to take away from this is it creates hatred for the self, because those hierarchies are damaging, as damaging to Paul Pinmay, although in different ways, as they are to Vithibhai. And I want to end today by just thinking about the title, right? It's a really funny sort of title, thinking about the life to come. And I want you to think of it as having three sort of meanings at once. And these are all sort of resonating in our ears when we think about this story. The first one is kind of obvious, and that is it's religious. It's an afterlife. It is what Paul tells Vithibhai will redeem their sufferings on earth. You know, we'll see each other in the life to come. So it's Christian. Vithibhai obviously thinks of it through a different religious framework. But both of them are imagining a spiritual afterlife. There's an obvious one here too, and I'll say it because I know you guys will be too embarrassed. Sexual, panankam, right? The life to come starts with a sexual encounter and is set, the whole plot is set off by a refusal to accept that sexuality, right? So I think we are meant to hear that resonance here too. And finally, and this is the one place where maybe we can be a bit hopeful. Actually, Forrester was a pretty hopeful guy. And that is that maybe historically, maybe with Paul Pinmay dead, maybe with Vithibhai dead, and maybe with a new historical era, we might have a more hopeful future, right? For both colonizer and colonized, in which we do not have these hierarchies that are so damaging to everyone, okay? So here are some things just to remember. Remember that Forrester is, first of all, one of the first people to be thinking about sexual identity. Second, he's one of the first people we've read this semester to think about how damaging that role of colonizer is. Two things I want to tell you before you go, so please don't start packing up yet. These are important. First, this is different. On Friday, you are reading George Orwell's Shooting an Elephant, and that essay will only be covered in section. So I don't want you to go to section just assuming it's like usual where you're discussing what we've covered. You are reading something, and you will find it, I think, quite interesting. This is a really compelling essay. And then on Monday, we're reading yet another Empire Strikes Back with The Man Who Liked Dickens. And just as a reminder, please remember that Monday, those revisions are due. And here are some reading questions to help you get the most out of both Orwell and Waugh, okay? Look for allusions to Conrad's Heart of Darkness. That is such a towering work that anybody who wants to write about the colonial situation has to have it in the back of their mind. Second, both of these writers are really going to set up their main characters quite carefully, and I want you to think about why we need the particular information about them that we get to understand the story. And then third, what we're seeing in all three of these are the thinking about the relationship between the natives and the colonizers. I want you to think about similarities and differences to what we just talked about today. Okay? That's it. I will see you guys on Monday, and you'll be in section with Orwell Friday.